Tessa.
Father, he said, I need your help, and quickly. I have a Pyxis, and I have the means to open it. I have the automaton bodies. I need only the spell you created, the binding spell. Write it down for me, and I will have the last piece of the puzzle.
The tiny flare of panic inside Tessa was growing and spreading. There was no touching reunion between father and son. This was something Mortmain wanted, needed from the warlock John Shade. She began to struggle, to try to extricate herself from the change, but it held her with a grip like iron. Not since the Dark Sisters had trained her had she been unable to extricate herself from a change, but though John Shade was dead, she could feel the steely hold of his will on her, keeping her prisoned in his body and forcing that body into action. In horror, she saw her own hand reach for the pen, dip the nib in the ink, and begin to write. The pen scratched across the paper. Mortmain leaned forward. He was breathing hard, as if running. Behind him the fire crackled high and orange in the grate. "That is it," he said, his tongue licking over his bottom lip. "I can see how that would work. Yes. Finally. That's it exactly." Tessa stared. What was coming from her pen seemed a stream of gibberish to her. Numbers, signs, and symbols she could not comprehend. Again she tried to struggle, succeeding only in blotting the page. There went the pen again. Ink, paper, more scratching. The hand that held the pen was shaking violently, but the symbols continued to flow. Tessa began to bite her lip hard and then harder. She tasted blood in her mouth. Some of the blood dripped onto the page. The pen continued to write through it, smearing scarlet fluid across the page. "That is it," Mortmain said. "Father!" The nib of the pen snapped as loud as a gunshot, echoing off the walls of the cave. The pen fell broken from Tessa's hand, and she slumped back against the chair, exhausted. The green was draining from her skin. Her body was shrinking. Her own brown hair was tumbling loose over her shoulders. She could still taste blood in her mouth. "No," she gasped, and reached for the papers. "No!" But her movements were made slow by pain and the change, and Mortmain was faster. Laughing, he snatched the papers out from under her hand and rose to his feet.
"Very good," he said. "Thank you, my little warlock girl. You have given me everything I need. Automatons, escort Miss Grey back to her room."
The metal hand closed on the back of Tessa's gown and lifted her to her feet. The world seemed to swing dizzily in front of her. She saw Mortmain reach down and lift up the gold watch that had fallen on the table. He smiled at it, a feral, vicious smile.
"I will make you proud, father," he said. "Never doubt it."
Tessa, no longer able to bear watching, closed her eyes.
"What have I done?"
she thought, as the automaton began to push her from the room.
"My God, what have I done?"
Chapter 17. Only Noble to Be Good. However it be, it seems to me, 'tis only noble to be good. Kind hearts are more than coronets, and simple faith than Norman blood. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Lady Clara Vere de Vere. Charlotte's dark head was bent over a letter when Gabriel came into the drawing room. It was chilly in the room, the fire dead in the grate. Gabriel wondered why Sophie had not built it up. Too much time spent training. His father wouldn't have had patience with that. He liked servants who were trained to fight, but he preferred them to acquire that knowledge before they entered his service. Charlotte looked up.
"Gabriel," she said. "You wanted to see me?"
Gabriel did his best to keep his voice even. He couldn't help the feeling that Charlotte's dark eyes could see through him, as if he were made of glass. His eyes flicked toward the paper on her desk.
"What is that?"
She hesitated. "A letter from the consul." Her mouth was twisted into a tight, unhappy line. She glanced down again and sighed.
"All I ever wanted was to run this institute as my father had.
I never thought it would be quite so hard. I shall write to him again, but... She broke off then, with a tight, false smile. But I did not ask you here to talk about myself, she said. Gabriel, you have looked tired these past few days, and tense. I know we are all distressed, and I fear that in that distress your situation may have been forgotten.
My situation?
Your father, she clarified, rising from her chair and approaching him. You must be grieving him.
What of Gideon? He said. He was his father too.
Gideon grieves your father some time ago, she said, and to his surprise, she was standing at his elbow. For you, it must be new and raw. I did not want you to think I had forgotten.
After everything that's happened,
he said, his throat starting to close with bewilderment, and something else, something he did not want to identify too closely.
After Jem and Will and Jessamine and Tessa, after your household has been very nearly cut in half,
you do not wish me to believe that you have forgotten me. She laid a hand on his arm. Those losses do not make your loss nothing.
That cannot be it, he said. You cannot want to comfort me. You ask me to find out if my loyalty is still to my father, or to the Institute.
Gabriel, no, nothing like that.
I can't give you the answer you want, Gabriel said. I cannot forget that he stayed with me. My mother died, and Gideon left, and Tatiana is a useless fool, and there was never anyone else. Never anyone else to bring me up, and I had nothing. Just my father. Just the two of us. And now you. You and Gideon. You expect me to despise him, but I can't. He was my father, and I...
His voice broke. Loved him, she said gently. You know, I remember you when you were just a little boy. And I remember your mother. And I remember your brother always standing next to you, and your father's hand on your shoulder. If it matters, I do believe he loved you too.
It doesn't matter, because I killed my father, Gabriel said in a shaking voice. I put an arrow through his eye. I spilled his blood. Patricide.
It was not patricide. He wasn't your father anymore.
If that was not my father, if I did not end my father's life, then where is he? Gabriel whispered. Where is my father?
And he felt Charlotte reach up to draw him down, to embrace him as a mother would, holding him as he choked dryly against her shoulder, tasting tears in his throat, but unable to shed them.
Where is my father?
He said again, and when she tightened her hold on him, he felt the iron in her grip, the strength of her holding him up, and wondered how he'd ever thought this small woman was weak.
To Charlotte Branwell, from Consul Josiah Wayland. My dear Mrs. Branwell, an informant whose name you cannot at this time disclose. I would venture a guess that there is no informant, and that it is all your own invention, a ploy to convince me of your rightness. Pray, cease your impression of a parrot, witlessly repeating, March upon Cad Adris at once, at all the hours of the day, and show me instead that you are performing your duties as a leader of the London Institute. Otherwise, I fear, I must suppose that you are unfit to do so, and will be forced to relieve you of them at once. As a token of your compliance, I must ask that you cease speaking of this matter entirely, and implore no members of the Enclave to join you in your fruitless quest. If I hear you have brought this matter before any other Nephilim, I shall consider it the gravest disobedience, and act accordingly. Josiah Wayland, Consul of the Clave.
Sophie had brought Charlotte the letter at the breakfast table. Charlotte pried it open with her butter knife, breaking through the Wayland seal, a horseshoe, with the C of the consul below it, and fairly tore it open in her eagerness to read. The rest of them watched her, Henry with concern on his bright, open face as two dark red spots bloomed slowly over Charlotte's cheekbones while her eyes scanned the lines. The others sat still, arrested over their meals, and Cecily could not help but think how it was strange in a way to see a group of men hanging upon the reaction of a woman. There was a smaller group of men than it should have been. The absence of Will and Jem felt like a new wound, a clean white slice not yet filled in with blood, the shock almost too fresh for pain.
"What is it?" Henry said anxiously. "Charlotte, dear."
Charlotte read the words of the message out with the emotionless beats of a metronome. When she was done, she pushed the letter away, still staring at it.
"I simply cannot," she began. "I do not understand."
Henry had flushed red beneath his freckles.
"How dare he write to you like that?"
he said, with unexpected ferocity.
"How dare he address you in that manner? Dismiss your concerns."
"Perhaps he is correct. Perhaps he is mad. Perhaps we all are," Charlotte said.
"We are not,"
Cecily exclaimed, and she saw Gabriel look sideways at her. His expression was difficult to read. He had been pale since he had come into the dining room, and had barely spoken or eaten, staring instead at the tablecloth as if it held the answers to all the questions in the universe.
"The Magister is in Cader Idris, I am sure of it."
Gideon was frowning.
"I believe you," he said. "We all do. But without the ear of the Consul, the matter cannot be placed before the Council. And without a Council, there can be no assistance for us."
"The portal is nearly ready for use," said Henry.
"When it works, we should be able to transport as many Shadow Hunters as needed to Cader Idris in a matter of moments."
"But there will be no Shadow Hunters to transport," said Charlotte. "Look here. The Consul forbids me to speak of the matter to the Enclave. Its authority supersedes mine. To overstep his command like that, we could lose the Institute."
"And?"
Cecily demanded heatedly.
"Do you care more for your position than you care for Will and Tessa?"
"Miss Herondale,"
Henry began, but Charlotte silenced him with a gesture. She looked very tired.
"No, Cecily, it is not that. But the Institute provides us protection. Without it, our ability to help Will and Tessa is severely compromised. As the head of the Institute, I can provide them assistance that a single Shadow Hunter could not."
"No," Gabriel said. He had pushed away his plate, and his slim fingers were tense and white as he gestured.
"You cannot."
"Gabriel," said Gideon in a questioning tone.
"I will not stay silent," Gabriel said, and rose to his feet, as if he intended to either make a speech or sprint away from the table. Cecily was not sure. He turned a haunted green gaze on Charlotte.
"The day that the Consul came here, when he brought me and my brother away for questioning, he threatened us until we promised to spy on you for him."
Charlotte paled. Henry began to stand up from the table. Gideon threw a hand out pleadingly.
"Charlotte," he said, "we never did it. We never told him a word. Nothing that was true, anyway," he amended, looking around as the rest of the occupants of the room stared at him.
"Some lies, misdirection. He stopped asking after only 2 letters. He knew there was no use in it."
"It's true, ma'am,"
came a small voice from the corner of the room. Sophie. Cecily almost hadn't noticed her there, pale under her white mob cap.
"Sophie!"
Henry sounded utterly shocked.
"You knew about this?"
"Yes, but..."
Sophie's voice shook.
"He threatened Gideon and Gabriel awfully, Mr. Brownwell. He told them he would have the Lightwoods stricken off the Shadow Hunter records, that he would have Tatiana turned out in the street. And still, they didn't tell him anything. When he stopped asking, I thought he'd realised that there was nothing to find out and given up. I'm so sorry. I just..."
"She didn't want to hurt you," Gideon said desperately. "Please, Mrs. Brownwell, do not blame Sophie for this."
"I don't," said Charlotte, her eyes dark and quick, moving from Gabriel to Gideon to Sophie and back again. "But I'd rather imagine there is more to this story, isn't there?"
"That is all there is, truly," Gideon began.
"No," Gabriel said, "it isn't. When I came to you, Gideon, and told you that the Consul no longer wanted us to report to him about Charlotte, that was a lie."
"What?"
Gideon looked horrified.
He brought me aside on my own the day of the attack on the Institute, Gabriel said. He told me that if I helped him discover some wrongdoings on Charlotte's part, he would give back the Lightwood estate to us, restore the honor to our name, cover up what our father did. He took a deep breath. And I told him I would do it. Gabriel, Gideon groaned, and buried his face in his hands. Gabriel looked as if he were about to be sick, half wavering on his feet. Cecily was torn between pity and horror, remembering that night in the training room, how she had told him she had faith in him, that he would make the right choices. "That is why you looked so frightened when I called you to speak with me earlier today," Charlotte said, her gaze steady on Gabriel. "You thought I'd found you out." Henry began to rise to his feet, his pleasant open face darkening with the first real anger Cecily thought she had ever seen on it. "Gabriel Lightwood," he said, "my wife has shown you nothing but kindness, and this is how you repay it." Charlotte put a restraining hand on her husband's arm. "Henry, wait," she said. "Gabriel, what did you do?" "I listened to your conversation with Aloysius Starkweather," Gabriel said in an empty voice. "I wrote a letter to the consul afterward, telling him that you were basing your requests that he march on Wales on the words of a madman, that you were credulous, too headstrong." Charlotte's eyes seemed to pierce through Gabriel like nails. Cecily thought she would never want that gaze on her, not in her life. "You wrote it," she said. "Did you send it?" Gabriel took a long, gasping breath. "No," he said, and reached into his sleeve. He drew out a folded paper and threw it down onto the table. Cecily stared at it. It was smudged with fingerprints and soft at the edges, as if it had been folded and unfolded many times. "I could not do it. I did not tell him anything at all." Cecily let out a breath she hadn't realized she had been holding. Sophie made a soft noise. She started toward Gideon, who was looking as if he were recovering from being punched in the stomach. Charlotte remained as calm as she had been throughout. She reached out, picked up the letter, glanced over it, and then placed it back on the table. "Why didn't you send it?" she said. He looked at her, an odd shared look that passed between them, and said, "I had my reasons to reconsider." "Why didn't you come to me?" Gideon said. "Gabriel, you are my brother. You cannot make all choices for me, Gideon. Sometimes I have to make my own. As shadow hunters, we are meant to be selfless, to die for mundanes, for the angel, and most of all for each other. Those are our principles. Charlotte lives by them. Father never did. I realized I had been mistaken before in putting my loyalty to my bloodline above principle, above everything. And I realized the consul was wrong about Charlotte." Gabriel stopped abruptly. His mouth was set in a thin white line. "He was wrong." He turned to Charlotte. "I cannot take back what I have done in the past, or what I considered doing. I know of no way to make it up to you, my doubt in your authority or my ungratefulness for your kindness. All I can do is tell you what I know, that you cannot wait for an approval from Consul Wayland that will never come. He will never march upon Cader Idris for you, Charlotte. He does not want to agree to any plan that has your stamp of authority on it. He wishes you out of the Institute, replaced."
"But he is the one who put me here," Charlotte said. "He supported me."
"Because he thought you would be weak," said Gabriel. "Because he believes women are weak and easily manipulated. But you have proved not to be, and it has ruined all his planning. He does not just desire you discredited. He needs it. He was clear enough with me that even if I could not discover you engaged in any true wrongdoing, he was granting me the freedom to invent a lie that would convict you, as long as it was a convincing one." Charlotte pressed her lips together.
"Then he never had faith in me," she whispered. "Never."
Henry tightened his grip on her arm.
"But he should have," he said. "He underestimated you, and that is not a tragedy. That you have proven to be better, cleverer, and stronger than anyone could have expected, Charlotte. It is a triumph."
Charlotte swallowed, and Cecily wondered, just for a moment, what it would be like to have someone look at her as Henry looked at Charlotte.
as if she were a wonder on earth.
What do I do?
What you think best, Charlotte, darling, said Henry. You are the leader of the enclave and of the institute, said Gabriel. We have faith in you, even if the consul does not. He ducked his head. You have my loyalty from this day forward, for whatever it is worth to you.
It is worth a great deal, Charlotte said,
and there was something in her voice, a quiet authority that made Cecily want to rise and proclaim her own loyalty, simply to win the balm of Charlotte's approval. Cecily couldn't imagine feeling that way, she realized, about the consul.
And that is why the consul hates her, she thought, because she is a woman, and yet he knows she can command loyalty in a way he never could.
We proceed as if the consul does not exist, Charlotte went on. If he is determined to remove me from my place here, then I have nothing to safeguard. It is simply a matter of doing what we must before he has the chance to stop us. Henry, how long before your invention is ready?
Tomorrow, Henry said promptly. I shall work through the night.
It will be the first time it is ever used, said Gideon. Does that not seem a bit risky?
We have no other way of getting to Wales in time, said Charlotte.
Once I send my message, we will have only a short time before the consul comes to relieve me of my place.
What message? Cecily asked, bewildered.
I am going to send a message to all the members of the clave, Charlotte said. At once. Not the enclave, the clave.
But only the consul is allowed, Henry began,
then shut his mouth like a box.
Ah!
I will tell them the situation as it stands, and ask for their assistance, said Charlotte. I'm not sure what response we can count on, but surely some will stand with us.
I will stand with you, said Cecily.
And I, of course, Gabriel said. His expression was resigned, nervous, considering, determined. Never had Cecily liked him more.
And I, said Gideon, though,
and his gaze, as it passed over his brother, was worried. A mere six of us, one only barely trained against whatever force Mortmain has mustered. Cecily was caught between pleasure that he had counted her as one of them, and annoyance that he had said she was barely trained.
It could be a suicide mission.
Sophie's soft voice spoke again.
You may have only six shadow hunters on your side, but you have at least nine fighters. I am trained as well, and I would like to fight alongside you. So will Bridget and Cyril.
Charlotte looked half pleased, half startled.
But, Sophie, you've only just begun to be trained.
I've been trained longer than Miss Arendelle, said Sophie.
Cecily is a shadow hunter.
Miss Collins has a natural talent, said Gideon. He spoke slowly, the conflict clear on his face. He did not want Sophie in the fighting, in danger, and yet would not lie about her abilities. She should be allowed to ascend and become a shadow hunter.
Gideon,
Sophie began, startled, but Charlotte was already looking at her with a keen, dark gaze.
Is that what you want, Sophie dear? To ascend?
Sophie stammered.
It is what I've always wanted, Mrs. Bramwell. But not if it meant I had to leave your service. You have been so kind to me, I would not wish to repay that by abandoning you.
Nonsense, Charlotte said. I can find another maid. I cannot find another Sophie.
If being a shadow hunter was what you wanted, my girl, I wish you had spoken. I could have gone to the consul before I was at odds with him.
Still, when we return...
She broke off, and Cecily heard the words beneath the words. If we return.
When we return, I will put you forward for ascension, Charlotte finished.
I will speak out for her case as well, Gideon said. After all, I have my father's place on the council. His friends will listen to me. They still owe loyalty to our family. And besides, how else can we be married?
What?
Said Gabriel, with a wild hand gesture that accidentally flipped the nearest plate onto the floor, where it shattered.
Married?
Said Henry.
You're marrying your father's friends on the council? Which of them?
Gideon had gone an odd sort of greenish colour. Clearly he had not meant those words to escape him, and he did not know what to do now that they had. He was staring at Sophie in horror, but it didn't seem she was likely to be much help either. She looked as shocked as a fish that had been stranded unexpectedly on land. Cecily stood up and dropped her serviette onto her plate. "All right," she said, doing her best to approximate the commanding tones her mother used when she needed something done about the house. "Everyone out of the room." Charlotte, Henry, and Gideon began to rise to their feet. Cecily threw her hands up. "Not you, Gideon Lightwood," she said. "Honestly. But you," she pointed at Gabriel. "Do stop staring. Come along." And taking him by the back of the jacket, she half-dragged him from the room, Henry and Charlotte hard on their heels. The moment they had left the dining room, Charlotte strode off toward the drawing room with the announced purpose of composing a message for the Clave, Henry by her side. She paused at the turn of the corridor to look back at Gabriel with an amused quirk of her mouth, but Cecily suspected he did not see it. Cecily put it out of her mind quickly regardless. She was too busy pressing her ear up against the dining room door, trying to hear what was going on inside. Gabriel, after a moment's pause, leaned back against the wall beside the door. He was equal parts pale and flushed, his pupils dilated with shock. "You shouldn't do that," he said finally. "Eavesdropping is most incorrect behaviour, Miss Herondale." "It's your brother," Cecily whispered, ear against the wood. She could hear murmurs inside, but nothing definite. "I should think you'd want to know." He ran both his hands through his hair and exhaled like someone who had been running a long distance. Then he turned to her and took a steely from his waistcoat pocket. He carved a rune quickly into his wrist, then placed his hands flat against the door. "I do, at that." Cecily's gaze darted from his hand to the thoughtful expression on his face. "Oh, can you hear them?" she demanded. "Oh, that is not at all fair." "It's all very romantic," Gabriel said, and then frowned. "Or it would be, if my brother could get a word out without sounding like a choking frog. I fear he will not go down in history as one of the world's great wooers of women." Cecily crossed her arms in vexation. "I do not see why you're being so difficult," she said. "Or are you bothered that your brother wishes to marry a servant girl?" The expression Gabriel turned on was fierce, and Cecily suddenly regretted tweaking him after what he had just been through. "Nothing I could think of him doing would be worse than what my father did. At least his taste runs to human women." And yet it was so difficult not to tweak him. He was so aggravating. "That is hardly a great endorsement for a woman as fine as Sophie." Gabriel looked as if he were about to deliver a sharp retort, but then he thought better of it. "I did not mean it like that. She is a fine girl, and will be a fine shadow hunter when she ascends. She'll bring honour to our family, and the angel knows we need it." "I believe you will bring honour to your family too," Cecily said quietly. "What you just did, what you confessed to Charlotte, that took courage." Gabriel was still for a moment, then he reached out his hand toward her. "Take my hand," he said. "You'll be able to hear what is going on in the dining room, through me, if you desire." After a moment's hesitation, Cecily took Gabriel's hand. It was warm and rough in hers. She could feel the thrum of his blood through his skin, oddly comforting. And indeed through him, as if she had had her own ear pressed to the door, she could hear the low rumble of spoken words. Gideon's soft, hesitant voice, and Sophie's delicate one. She closed her eyes and listened. "Oh," said Sophie faintly, and sat down in one of the chairs. "Oh, my." She could not help but sit. Her legs felt wobbly and uneasy. Gideon, meanwhile, was standing by the sideboard, looking panicked. His blonde brown hair was tousled wildly, as if he had been running his hands through it. "My dear Miss Collins," he began. "This is..." she began and paused. "I don't... this is quite unexpected."
"Is it?"
Gideon moved away from the sideboard and leaned on the table. His shirt sleeves were rolled up slightly, and Sophie found herself staring at his wrists, down with faint blonde hair and marked with the white memories of marks.
"Surely you must have been able to see the respect and esteem I had for you. The admiration."
Wow, Sophie said. Admiration. She managed to make it sound like a very pale word indeed. Gideon flushed. My dear Miss Collins, he began again, it is true that my feelings for you go far beyond admiration. I would describe them as the most ardent affection. Your kindness, your beauty, your generous heart, they have quite overset me, and it is to that alone that I can ascribe my behavior of this morning. I do not know what came over me, to speak the dearest wishes of my heart aloud. Please do not feel obligated to accept my proposal, simply because it was public. Any embarrassment over the matter would and should be mine. Sophie looked up at him. Color was coming and going in his cheeks, making his agitation clear. But you haven't proposed. Gideon looked startled. What? You haven't proposed, Sophie said with equanimity. You did announce to the old breakfast table that you intended to marry me, but that is not a proposal. That is only a declaration. A proposal is when you ask me.
Now that's putting my brother in his place, said Gabriel,
looking delighted in the manner that younger siblings did when their brothers or sisters were entirely set down.
Oh, shush, whispered Cecily, squeezing his hand hard. I want to hear what Mr. Lightwood says.
Very well, then, said Gideon, in the decided yet slightly terrified manner of St. George setting off to fight the dragon. A proposal it shall be. Sophie's eyes tracked him as he crossed the room toward her and knelt down at her feet. Life was an uncertain thing, and there were some moments one wished to remember, to imprint on one's mind, that the memory might be taken out later, like a flower pressed between the pages of a book, and admired and recollected anew. She knew she would not want to forget the way Gideon reached for her hand with his own hand trembling, or the way he bit his lip before he spoke.
My dear Miss Collins, he said, please forgive me for my untoward outburst. It was simply that I have such strong esteem, no, not esteem, adoration for you, that I feel as if it must blaze from me every moment of the day. Ever since I came to this house, I have been struck more forcibly each day by your beauty, your courage, and your nobility. It is an honor I could never deserve, but most earnestly aspire to, if only you could be mine. That is, if you would consent to be my wife.
Gracious, Sophie said, startled out of all countenance. Have you been practicing that? Gideon blinked. I assure you it was entirely extemporaneous.
Well, it was lovely.
Sophie squeezed his hands. And yes, I love you. And yes, I will marry you, Gideon. A brilliant smile broke out over his face, and he startled both of them by reaching for her and kissing her soundly on the mouth. She held his face between her hands as they kissed. He tasted slightly of tea leaves, and his lips were soft and the kiss entirely sweet. Sophie floated on it, in the prism of the moment, feeling safe from all the rest of the world. Until Bridget's voice broke in on her happiness, drifting lugubriously from the kitchen.
On a Tuesday they were wed, and by Friday they were dead. And they buried them in the churchyard, side by side. Oh, my love, and they buried them in the churchyard, side by side.
Breaking away from Gideon with some reluctance, Sophie rose to her feet and dusted off her dress.
Please forgive me, my dear Mr. Lightwood, I mean Gideon, but I must go and murder the cook. I shall be directly back. Oh, Cecily breathed. That was so romantic.
Gabriel took his hand away from the door and smiled down at her. His face quite changed when he smiled. All the sharp lines were softened, and his eyes went from the colour of ice to the green of leaves in spring sunshine.
Are you crying, Miss Herondale?
She blinked damp eyelashes, suddenly aware that her hand was still in his. She could still feel the soft pulse beat in his wrist against hers. He leaned toward her, and she caught the early morning scent of him, tea and shaving soap. She pulled away hastily, freeing her hand.
Thank you for allowing me to listen, she said.
I need to go to the library. There is something I must do before tomorrow.
His face crinkled in confusion.
Cecily?
But she was already hurrying away down the corridor without looking back.
2. Edmund and Lynette Herondale, Raven Scarmanagh, West Riding, Yorkshire. Dear Mam and Dad, I have started this letter to you so many times and never sent it. At first it was guilt. I knew I'd been a willful, disobedient girl in leaving you, and I could not face the evidence of my wrongdoing in stark black letters on a page. After that it was homesickness. I missed you both so much. I missed the rich green hills, sweeping away from the manor, and all the heather, all purple in the summer, and Mam singing in the garden. It was cold here, all black and brown and grey, pea-soup fogs and choking air. I thought I might die of loneliness, but how could I tell you that? After all, it was what I had chosen. And then it was sorrow. I had planned to come here and bring Will back with me, to make him see where his duty lay, and bring him home. But Will has his own ideas about duty and honour, and the promises he has made. And I came to see that I could not bring someone home when they were already there, and I did not know how to tell you that. And then it was happiness. That may seem so very strange to you, as it did to me, that I would not be able to return home because I had found contentment. As I trained to become a shadow hunter, I felt the stirring in my blood, the same stirring Mam always spoke of feeling every time we came from Welshpool into the site of Davy Valley. With a seraph blade in hand, I am more than just Cecily Herondale, youngest of three, daughter of good parents, someday to make an advantageous marriage and give the world children. I am Cecily Herondale, shadow hunter. And mine is a high and glorious position. Glory. Such an odd word. Something women are not supposed to want. But is not our queen triumphant? Was not Queen Bess called Gloriana? But how could I tell you? I had chosen glory over peace. The hard-bought peace you had left the clave to provide for me. How could I say I was happy as a shadow hunter without it causing you the grievous unhappiness? This is the life you turned away from, the life from whose dangers you sought to shelter Will and me and Ella. What could I tell you that would not break your hearts? Now it is understanding. I have come to realize what it means to love someone more than you love yourself. I realize now that all you ever wanted was not for me to be like you, but to be happy. And you gave me... You gave us a choice. I see those who have grown up in the clave and who never had a choice about what they wished to be. And I am grateful for what you did. To have chosen this life is a very different thing from having been born into it. The life of Jessamine Lovelace has taught me that. And as for Will, and bringing him home, I know, Mam, you feared that shadow hunters would take all the love out of your gentle boy. But he is loved. And loving. He has not changed. And he loves you, as do I. Remember me, for I will always remember you. Your loving daughter, Cecily.
2. Members of the Clave of the Nephilim. From Charlotte Bramwell. My dear brothers and sisters in arms, it is my sad duty to relate to you all that despite the fact that I have presented Consul Whelan with incontrovertible proof provided by one of my shadow hunters that Mortmain, the gravest threat the Nephilim has faced in our times, is resident at Cader Idris in Wales, our esteemed Consul has mysteriously decided to ignore this information. I myself regard knowledge of the location of our enemy and the opportunity to defeat his plans for our destruction as of the deepest importance. By means provided to me by my husband, the renowned inventor Henry Branwell, the shadow hunters at my disposal in the London Institute will be proceeding with utmost dispatch to Cader Idris, there to lay down our lives in an attempt to stop Mortmain. I am most grieved to leave the Institute undefended,
but if Consul Whalen can be roused to any action at all, he is most welcome to send guards to defend a deserted building. There are but 9 of our number, 3 of them not even shadow hunters, but brave mundanes, trained by us at the Institute, who have volunteered to fight beside us. I cannot say that our hopes at this time are high, but I believe the attempt must be made. Obviously, I cannot compel any of you. As Consul Wayland has reminded me, I am not in a position to command the forces of the Shadowhunters, but I would be most obliged if any of you who agree with me that Mortmain must be fought and fought now will come to the London Institute tomorrow, at midday, and render us your assistance. Yours truly, Charlotte Bramwell, Head of the London Institute. Chapter 18. For This Alone. For this alone on death I wreak the wrath that garners in my heart. He put our lives so far apart, we cannot hear each other speak. Alfred Lord Tennyson. In Memoriam. A. H. H. Tessa stood at the edge of a precipice, in a country she did not know. The hills about her were green, dropping off sharply into cliffs that sheered down toward a blue sea. Seabirds wheeled and cawed above her. A grey path wound like a snake along the edge of the clifftop. Just ahead of her, on the path, stood Will. He wore black gear, and over it a long black riding coat, spattered with mud at the hem, as if he had been walking a long way. He was without hat or gloves, and his dark hair was tousled by the wind off the sea. The wind lifted Tess's hair as well, bringing the scent of salt and brine, of the wet things that grow at the edge of the sea, a smell that reminded her of her sea voyage on the main. "Will!" she called out. There was something so lonely about the figure he cut, like Tristan watching across the Irish Sea for the ship that would bear Isolde back to him. Will did not turn at the sound of her voice, only raised his arms, his coat lifting in the wind, sweeping out behind him like wings. Fear rose up in her heart. Isolde had come for Tristan, but it had been too late. He had died of grief. "Will!" she called again. He stepped forward, off the cliff. She raced to the edge and looked down, but there was nothing there, only plunging grey-blue water and white surf. The tide seemed to carry his voice to her with each surge of water.
"Awake, Tessa, awake! Awake, Miss Grey! Miss Grey!"
Tessa jerked upright. She had fallen asleep in the chair by the fireplace in her small prison. A coarse blue blanket was drawn over her, though she did not remember procuring it. The room burned with torchlight, and the coals of the fire were low. It was impossible to tell if it was day or night. Mortmain stood before her, and beside him was an automaton. It was one of the more humanoid that Tessa had seen. It was even clothed, as not many of them were, this one in a military tunic and trousers. The clothes made the head that rose above the stiff collar look even more uncanny, with its 2 smooth features and bald metallic scalp. And its eyes, she knew they were glass and crystal, the irises red in the firelight, but the way they seemed to fix on her.
"You're called," Mortmain said.
Tessa exhaled, and her breath came out in a white puff. "The warmth of your hospitality leaves something to be desired." He smiled, thin-lipped.
"Very amusing."
He himself was wearing a heavy astrakhan coat over a grey suit, ever the businessman.
"Miss Grey, I do not wake you lightly. I came because I wish you to see what your kind assistance with my father's memories has allowed me to accomplish."
He gestured proudly at the automaton by his side. "Another automaton?" Tessa said without interest.
"How rude of me."
Mortmain's eyes flicked to the creature.
"Introduce yourself."
The creature's mouth opened. Tessa caught a flash of brass. It spoke.
"I am Armorus," it said.
For 1 billion years I rode the winds of the great abysses between the worlds. I fought Jonathan Shadowhunter on the plains of Brocklin. For 1,000 more years I lay trapped within the Pyxis. Now my master has freed me, and I serve him.
Tessa rose, the blanket sliding to her feet, unheeded. The automaton was watching her. Its eyes were full of dark intelligence, a consciousness that no automaton she had seen before had ever possessed.
"What is this?" she said in a whisper.
"An automaton body, animated by a demon spirit. Downworlders already have their ways of capturing demon energies and using them. I use them myself to power the automatons you've seen before. But Amaros and his brothers are different. They are demons with carapaces of automatons. They can think and reason. They are not easily outwitted, and they are very difficult to kill."
Amaros reached across its body. Tessa could not help but note that it moved fluidly, smoothly, without the jerkiness of the automatons she had seen before. It moved like a person. It drew the sword that hung at his side and handed it to Mortmain. The blade was covered in the runes that Tessa had become so familiar with over the last months, the runes that decorated the blades of all Shadowhunter weapons, the runes that made them Shadowhunter weapons, the runes that were deadly to demons. Amaros should barely have been able to look upon the blade, much less hold it. Her stomach clenched. The demon gave the sword to Mortmain, who handled it with the precision of a long-time naval officer. He spun the blade, swept it forward, and drove it into the demon's chest. There was a sound of tearing metal. Tessa was used to seeing automatons crumple when attacked, or spurt black fluid, or stagger. But the demon stood its ground, unblinking and unmoving, like a lizard in the sun. Mortmain twisted the hilt savagely, then jerked the weapon free. Its blade crumbled to ash, like a log burned away in a fire.
"You see," said Mortmain, "they are an army designed to destroy Shadowhunters."
Amaros was the only automaton Tessa had ever seen smile. She did not even know their faces had been built to accomplish such a purpose. The demon said, "They have destroyed many of my kind. It will be a pleasure to kill them all."
Tessa swallowed hard, but tried to not let the Magister see it. His gaze was flicking back and forth from her to the demon automaton, and it was hard for her to say which he looked more delighted to lay eyes on. She wanted to scream, to throw herself at him and claw his face, but the invisible wall lay between them, shimmering slightly, and she knew she could not breach it.
"Oh, you ought to be more than his bride, Miss Grey," Mrs. Black had said. "You are to be the ruin of the Nephilim. That is why you were created."
"The Shadowhunters will not be so easily destroyed," she said. "I have seen them cut apart your automatons. Perhaps these cannot be felled by their ruined weapons, but any blade can shear metal and cut wires."
Mortmain shrugged.
"Shadowhunters are not used to battling creatures against whom their ruined weapons are useless. It will slow them. And there are countless of these automatons. It will be like trying to beat back the tide."
He cocked his head to the side.
"You see now, the genius of what I have invented. But I must thank you, Miss Grey, for that last piece of the puzzle. I thought perhaps even you might be admiring of what we have created together."
"Admiring?" She looked in his eyes for mockery, but there was something of a sincere question there, curiosity mixed with coldness. She thought of how long it must have been since he had had the praise of another human being, and took a deep breath. "You are obviously a great inventor," she said. Mortmain smiled, pleased. Tessa was aware of the gaze of the mechanical demon on her, its tension and readiness, but she was more aware of Mortmain. Her heart was beating hard inside her chest. She seemed, as she had in her dream, poised on the edge of a precipice. To speak to Mortmain like this was chancy, and she would either fall or fly. But she must take the chance. "I see why you have brought me here," she said. "And it is not just because of your father's secrets." There was anger in his eyes, but also a certain confusion. She was not behaving as he had expected her to behave.
"What do you mean?"
"You are lonely," she said. "You have surrounded yourself with these creatures that are not real, that do not live. We see our own souls in the eyes of others. How long has it been since you have seen that you have a soul?" Mortmain's eyes narrowed.
"I had a soul. It was burned away by what I have dedicated my life to, the pursuit of justice and recompense."
"Do not seek revenge and call it justice."
The demon gave a low chuckle, though there was contempt in it, as if he were watching the antics of a kitten.
"You would let her speak to you like that, master," he said. "I can cut out her tongue for you, silence her forever."
"It would serve nothing to mutilate her. She has powers you know not of," said Mortmain, his eyes still on Tessa. "There is an old saying in China, perhaps your beloved fiancé familiarized you with it, that states, a man may not live under the same heaven with the slayer of his father. I shall erase the shadow hunters from under heaven. They will not live long upon the earth. Do not seek to appeal my better nature, Tessa, for I have none."
Tessa could not help herself. She thought of A Tale of Two Cities, of Lucy Manette's appeals to Sidney Carton's better nature. She had always thought of Will as Sidney, consumed by sin and despair against his own better knowledge, even against his own desire. But Will was a good man, a much better one than Carton had ever been, and Mortmain was barely a man at all. It was not his better nature she appealed to, but his vanity. All men thought of themselves as good in the end, surely. No one believed themselves a villain. She took a breath.
"Surely that is not so. Surely you might again be worthy and good. You have done what you set out to do. You have brought life and intelligence to these infernal devices of yours. You have created that which might destroy the Shadow Hunters. All your life you have pursued justice because you believed the Shadow Hunters were corrupt and vicious. Now, if you stay your hand, you win the greatest victory. You show that you are better than they."
She searched Mortmain's face with her eyes. Surely there was some hesitation there. Surely the thin lips were shaking slightly. Surely there was a tension of doubt in his shoulders. His mouth quirked into a smile.
"You think, then, that I can be a better man? And if I were to do as you say, to stay my hand, you would have me believe that you would stay with me out of admiration, that you would not return to the Shadow Hunters?"
"Why, yes, Mr. Mortmain. I swear it." She swallowed against the bitterness in her throat. If she had to remain with Mortmain in order to save Will and Jem, to save Charlotte and Henry and Sophie, she would do it.
"I believe you can find your better self. I believe we all can." His thin lips turned up at the corners.
"It is afternoon already, Miss Grey," he said. "I did not wish to wake you earlier. Come with me now, outside the mountain. Come and see this day's work. For there is something that I wish to show you."
A finger of ice touched her spine. She straightened.
"And what is that?"
His smile spread across his face.
"What I have been waiting for."
2. Consul de Sir Wayland, from Inquisitor Victor Whitelaw. Josiah, forgive my informality, for I write in haste. I am certain that this will not be the only letter you will receive on this subject. In fact, it is likely not even the first. I myself have already received many. Each touches upon the same question that burns in my mind. Is Charlotte Brownwell's information correct? For if so, it seems to me that there is a more than likely chance that the Magister is indeed in Wales. I know of your doubts in the veracity of William Hellendale, but we both knew his father. A hasty soul, and too greatly ruled by his passions, but a more honest man you could not find. I do not think the younger Herondale a liar. Regardless, as a result of Charlotte's message, the Clave is in chaos. I insist that we hold a dedicated council meeting immediately. If we do not, the trust of the Shadow Hunters in their consul and their Inquisitor will be irrevocably eroded. I leave the announcement of the meeting in your hands, but this is not a request. Send out the call for the council, or I shall resign my position and let it be known why. Victor Whitelaw.
Will was awoken by screams. Years of training made themselves known instantly. He was on the floor, in a crouch, before he was even properly awake. Glancing around, he saw that the small room of the inn was empty save for himself and the furniture. Narrow bed and plain deal table, barely visible in the shadows, was undisturbed. The screams came again, louder. They were emanating from outside the window. Will rose to his feet, crossed the room soundlessly, and twitched one of the curtains back to look out. He barely remembered walking into town, leading Balios behind him, the horse clopping slowly in exhaustion. A small Welsh town, like other small Welsh towns, unremarkable in any particular way. He had found the local public house easily, and turned Balios over to the ministrations of the stable boy, ordering the horse rubbed down and fed, a hot bran mash to revive him. The fact that he spoke Welsh had seemed to relax the innkeeper, and he had been shown quickly to a private room, where he collapsed almost immediately, fully clothed, onto the bed, and fallen into dreamless sleep. The moon was bright above, its position indicating that it was not yet late in the evening. A grey haze seemed to hang over the town. For a moment, Will thought it was a mist. Then inhaling, he realized it was smoke. Patches of bright red leaped up among the houses in the town. He narrowed his eyes. Figures were darting back and forth within the shadows. More screams, a flash that could only be blades. He was out the door with his boots half-laced in barely a moment, Seraph blade in hand. He pounded down the steps and into the main room of the inn. It was dark and cold. There was no fire, and several of the windows had been smashed in, letting in the chill night air. Glass glittered the floor like chunks of ice. The door hung open, and as Will slipped through it, he saw that the upper hinges were nearly torn out of their mooring, as if someone had tried to rip the door free. He slipped out of the door and ran the side of the inn, where the stables were. The smell of smoke hung thicker here, and he darted ahead, and nearly tripped over a humped figure on the ground. He dropped to his knees. It was the stable boy, his throat cut, the ground under him a sodden mess of blood and dirt. His eyes were open, staring, his skin already cold. Will swallowed back bile and straightened up. He moved toward the stables mechanically, his mind racing over the possibilities. A demon attack? Or had he stumbled into the middle of something non-supernatural? Some feud between townsfolk, or God only knew what? No one seemed to be looking for him in particular, that much was clear. He could hear Balios's anxious whickering as he let himself into the stable. It appeared undisturbed, from the plaster ceiling to the cobbled floor crisscrossed with drainage ditches. No other horses were stabled there that night, which was lucky, for the moment he opened the stall door, Balios plunged forward, nearly knocking Will over. Will was only just able to dart out of the way as the horse hurtled past him and out the door.
Balios!
Will swore, and he took off after his horse, pounding around the side of the inn and into the main road of the town. He stopped dead. The street was in chaos. Bodies lay crumpled, discarded at the side of the road like so much rubbish. Homes stood with their doors ripped open, windows smashed in. People were running in and out of the shadows haphazardly, screaming and calling for one another. Several of the houses were burning. As Will stared in horror, he saw a family spill from the door of a burning house, the father in a nightshirt, coughing and choking, a woman behind him holding the hand of a small girl. They had barely staggered into the street when shapes rose up out of the shadows. Moonlight sparked off metal. Automatons. They moved fluidly, without faltering or jerkiness. They wore clothes, a motley assortment of military uniforms, some recognisable to Will and some not. But their faces were bare metal.